Amazing.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We're here with Kirk this evening. And my pleasure to be with you. It's been an interesting week for me, Kirk. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of things that don't normally happen in a week. How was your week?
Eventful, but not nothing. Mostly just rain.
Well, I had two things that happened, maybe three that happened this week. One is that my ex reneged on a promise to release the trust funds that I had funded for my sons. They were many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. And she not only established herself as a in a joint survivorship account so that if they were to pass away, she would be the heir of their trust funds, which is pretty repulsive. But that here they are in their 30s, and there were no codicils of any kind on these trust funds. So they were adult, were going to rely on their judgment to use them as they saw fit. And she left herself in a position where, without her express written consent, they can't access their funds. So I had, had some discussion with her via her attorney on how that was inappropriate, and maybe she ought to change that. And in so doing, one of my two sons and I, who were very, very close, ended up continuing to bond. Can be an interesting father-son experience in trying to encourage my son to, to strategize. He's a little more of a feeler. You know, there's feelers, perceivers, if you will, and judgers. I'm probably not surprised to anybody. I'm a judger. And I make decisions quickly and then come up with a strategy and move forward. And a lot of people are far more perceptive. They're more in tune with their feelings and the feelings of others. And so we really had a kind of a series of heart-to-hearts on what is the best strategy here. Because, you know, a lot of times we want, for all the right reasons, what we can't have. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have loved to have stayed married if my wife wasn't so, delusional and debilitating and emasculating and derogatory towards me. But I couldn't. I couldn't fix her, and I couldn't endure it. So no matter how much I may have wanted something, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't endure it any longer. And so, you know, we had those discussions, and there's a lot of things like that in life where our heart wants to fix it, but our mind should know that this is not a good thing. And I talk a lot about it, Kirk, because I think it's really important in terms of judgment and in terms of our own execution of our lives. Yeah. I talk about a lot of times about World War II, where America sought to avenge the death of 3,000 U.S. Naval personnel by sacrificing the lives of 300,000.
Yes.
And for me, that's grossly immoral. We should be remorseful that we did that as opposed to proud of it. When we invaded Iraq because Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, but simply made a bad situation worse, with a million deaths as a consequence. It's unless something is done for the right reasons, unless you really thoroughly understand the situation, and unless you know that you have a high probability of making it better,
yeah,
you ought not do it.
Agreed.
You know, and that is in terms of our witness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to walk into a church to say, you know, you're all crazy, there is a zero probability that Christianity is true, or Muhammad was a sexual pervert and a terrorist. Why would you follow the advice of the most despicable person who ever lived? What do you think your chances are that that effort's going to turn out beneficial for anyone?
Very slim.
Zero. And the likelihood of something bad happening is really high. So that was really part of my week, is dealing with issues that are emotional,
mm-hmm,
but from a probability, analytical standpoint, which I think we have to do sometimes.
Yeah.
That's what I think made Dode so spectacular. He was fully intellectual and fully emotional. And the combination of the two is powerful, but very few people have the combination of the two. They lean one or the other. The other thing that was, and part of that experience is that my relationship with my eldest son, you know, just all but disintegrated. And, yeah, that's bad. I want to do my best to give it another shot this weekend, but it's not, you know. Again, probability, based upon what he had to say, is such that it's not good. But, you know, I had a sleepless night last night, agonizing over that, and I woke up this morning not only energized with the realization that all you can do is give it the best opportunity for resolution. And if you fail, what you're left with is the best job in the world. You know, I may not, as a result of this, be able to offer support and encouragement to my grandchildren. That's a very real consequence of this.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can't do that, I still have the best job that's ever been offered anyone. Same job that you have, by the way. And it is the best job in the world. Where we can definitely and in a very meaningful way help the members of your own family.
Yes, indeed.
And so this morning I came down more energized than I've ever been before, and I had the single best day I've ever had. Providing insights into what was probably the most misunderstood passage in the entirety of the Torah. And I was just like goosebumps from every moment. And the other thing that happened this week, I want to talk a little about that, what I was translating and commenting on, because it easily occurred the most profoundly enlightening thing, the most profoundly differentiating thing that I may have ever done, ever been part of.
Right.
So I did something this week that, Kirk, I haven't done in a very, very long time, that I avoid like you can't believe. A lot of people don't like it because I avoid it, but it's just, it suits what I who I am and what I'm doing. I almost never meet with anyone who reads my books or listens to the show. Almost ever. You know, I met with Dr. Jeff Grill years ago, and what a wonderful man. We had a great time together. Of course, I know Yoel because I knew him well before the title of this program, and one of the finest people I've ever come to know. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with my youngest son, who was Covenant. And there have been others along the way that I have met, but they're few and far between. And my issue really is that I'm so public. I take so many hits, both from Muslims, where I've had thousands and thousands of death threats, and from those who claim to be part of the Covenant. In fact, the conspiratorialists have raised their ugly head again.
Really?
And they've even tried to infect the Facebook site that has been so wonderful to so many, which is Shemar Torah, by promoting, in this case, the laughable myth of chemtrails. And really all it is a desperate plea for attention. Because the only credibility, the only attention that they get that helps them maintain their following is when they go after us, because we're what they used to generate some credibility. And, you know, my instruction with those instructors is to pay no attention to them. You know, one of the things that I learned, Kirk, because I had a chance to read the research that was done recently on the advocates of conspiracy theory. Do you know that they have one common denominator? It's probably, you probably think that men would be more likely to be conspiratorial than women, wouldn't you?
That's kind of a leading question.
They're not proponents.
It's high, JP. No, they're not. There's no difference between the men and the women who are proponents of conspiracy. You would think that right-wing wackos would be more likely to believe that their government is out to get them and is doing things like killing them with nanoparticles out of jet engines and staging the mass killings at places, you know, like the nightclubs at that New Zealand mosque, deliberately blowing up Building 7. You'd think that the nincompoops that are prone to believe such stuff would be right-wing wackos, wouldn't you? Like the Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria. Being a site for the Clintons to enslave children for pedophiles. Yeah. So you think that nonsense would be by right-wing wackos, wouldn't you? The media would let you believe that. Do you know there's no distinction between the percentage of liberals and conservatives that believe in the conspiracy?
That's surprising.
Right down the middle.
Right down the middle. There is one common denominator. Do you know what it is, JP?
A need to feel
secure. There's one thing that almost all conspiratorial buffs have in common, according to the research.
I don't know.
You know what it is?
I got a need to feel superior.
Yeah, they're losers. They're failing at life. They have no control over their lives. So rather than accept responsibility, they're lashing out at others, claiming that others are precluding them from having the life they deserve. That's the one common denominator. Their lives are out of control. They're failing. And rather than take accountability or responsibility, they want to blame others. That's the one common denominator. So if you're an advocate of a conspiracy, not only are you in direct conflict with Yahweh's instructions, you're identifying yourself with fellow losers. Now, what I want to share to you is that I've had a ball on translating commentary. I finished Volume 2 of Observations for a Time. I was really pleased with that, you know, because it was well over 1,000 pages. This sucker's long. And I've worked on it for a very long time. Finally finished Chapter 13, and I was a chapter on exposing America, and added some really spectacular things with a mizmor that explains what was being revealed in it, and then the Song of the Sea is the conclusion of it. just riveting. And I said, I'm all done. But I said, no, I'm not done. Because I started translating the first chapter of Volume 3. And I was going to begin in the parallel passages of the last days that begin in Yirmiyah 48 and make their way through about 51 or 52 in Yirmiyah. And you know how the Yah's depiction of the end of the world begins?
No.
The same way it did in Yashiyah. With the condemnation and demise of Moab. Do you know when Moab, as a kingdom, fought its last battle?
Gosh, that was almost Iron Age or something, wasn't it? A long time ago.
850 BCE.
Yeah, long time ago. Yeah.
The last mention, other than in the future, what they represent, was when a band of Moabites serving as a raiding party. So, not the kingdom, just some Moabites as part of a raiding party, nothing but a raiding party. Got honorable mention along with seven or eight other raiding parties for participating with the Babylonians in the conquest of Yehuda. But they weren't a kingdom by then.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, Moab was long gone. 150 years before Yashiyah or Yirmiyah wrote their prophecies about their demise. Now, for God to say, I'm predicting that a kingdom that had been obliterated 150 years before the prediction is going to be decimated.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a prediction is it?
No. That's an easy call.
That's an easy call. So Moab represents something else. And that was my call based upon history as I wrote the third to last chapter of the second volume. And it's been retitled, Where the Torah's Voice Died.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came up against it again in Yirmiyah 48. I said, you know, I've done God a disservice. I use history to come to a conclusion. And even if it's right, that's not been the basis of any of these books.
No.
The basis of the books is, what does God have to say?
Yeah.
So what I did is I began to translate all of the early stories about Moab from its first mention to its last mention as a kingdom. And, oh, man! You just shake with excitement as God explains who Moab really is. Do you know the first mention of Moab? Where it comes?
No, no.
Jimmy, you're a guy that started off translating Bar Rashid. There's a clue. It begins in Bar Rashid.
Yeah, it's in one of the descendants of Noah, right?
Nope. Lot. Lot.
Oh, Lot. That's right.
Lot. So, you know, in the 17th chapter of Bereshit, God presents the final and fifth condition of participating in the covenant, circumcision. And right after he speaks of circumcision and says, no one's going to participate in this covenant if it's not circumcised, he announces the impending arrival of Yishak. That's Yirmiyah 17. And Yirmiyah 22, Yahweh picks up the story of Abraham, Yishak, and the covenant with the test, the final affirmation, confirmation of the covenant with Abraham. Here's where the story of Sodom and Gomorrah stands.
You're very close.
Right in between them.
Oh, yeah, because he let them go to the plains, and he chose the plains and separated them.
Right in between them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is not a story of a father telling a bunch of hooligans they could gang rape his daughters.
Hardly.
Not that at all. It's not even a bunch of hooligans wanting to rape Yahweh's Malach messengers. neither are part of the story. In the most profoundly telling and vivid story of the difference between God's way and man's way. And what God is doing with that vivid story of Sodom and Gomorrah is saying, before you choose, now that you've accepted and you know the five conditions of the covenant, now that you know what those are and you know what the five benefits are, before you affirm with me as Abraham and Isaac did, that you're ready to confirm your decision to be part of this covenant, and you answer my invitation to begin by participating in Pesach, I want you to be absolutely certain that you understand exactly what you're walking away from. Sodom. The way of man. And wouldn't you know it, as I'm translating this, and I'm finding, wait a minute, this is nothing like the story that reads in the English translations. I mean, there's almost no correlation between the two. I came to realize that based upon a passage that a friend shared with me when I was doing this, Sodom equals Moab. They're equivalent. And Moab equals today's society.
That makes sense. Questionable.
Moab, today's society, as it is reflected in the life and times of Sodom. In other words, from God's perspective, the world today is indistinguishable from Sodom. Sodom equals Moab equals today's world of men. And that is me. And so this story is just riveting, right down to single details. Do you know how many Malach were sent to Sodom?
I thought there were two.
There are two. How many witnesses is Yahweh sending to the world of Sodom, circa
2033? Two?
Yeah, between 20 and 29 and 2033, they'll be here that whole time.
Okay.
How many?
More?
Two. Yeah. The whole story of Sodom is told with language that depicts not just what was, but what will be. As I said, now I've been doing this 18 years. In fact, I was writing this, as you know, it's been 18 books in 18 years. And never have I come across a story that was more perfectly placed or more vividly presented on what we need to know to differentiate between these things, or any place where we had a better, more clear-cut depiction of what God despises, which is people worshiping the Lord as if the Lord were God. Remember what Moab was convicted of, and why Moshe, after God said, I want you to kill every man involved with Baal, I want you to kill. The whole story was about the women of Moab seducing the Israelites into having not only sexual relationships with them, but into worshiping Baal. In fact, it was Baal Peor, which I goofed before. I looked at Or and said, you know, Lord of Light. I was wrong. It's not the Or of Light. It's the Or. The Peor is the Lord of the open and broad way.
Wow.
The Lord of Christianity.
Yeah.
Oh my. I tell you, it's one of those things where, I'm still writing it, so this chapter 11 of volume 2, And JB, I understand that you've updated all the chapters on your site and added all the new ones, with the exception of Chapter 11 of Volume 2, which I told you I'm still working on. When it started... And I had done the whole story of Moab, and it was obvious that Moab was talking about multiculturalism, political correctness, and most especially Pauline Christianity. I think it was like 45 pages, and I think I'm in the mid-90s now and still going. And based upon what I'm finding, I may be at it for another month. But you know, you go where the war's late, right?
Absolutely.
You just keep on tracking it down until you get the answer. Well, interesting stuff. Well, what we wanted to do today is to conclude Chapter 17. There was a Chapter 17, I think the only one in Nishiyashiga 17 is Chapter 12 of Volume 2 of Observations for Our Time. The only one where at the end of it, I decided, you know, I think what we need to do is have a summation of each statement, and then just with the summation of that statement, talk about what it represents. So, recognizing that it's been a while since, on this program, the prophecies of Yashiga 17 were presented one after another. Mm-hmm. I'd like to propose a journey through their compelling predictions. This time I want to just emphasize the order of events and try to extrapolate from what was said to what we should expect. Fair enough?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, 17.1. This is Yashiga, Isaiah 17.1. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus, the weeping sore covered in dung, which is prodded into being contemptible and abhorred. There's a clue. God doesn't much like Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished by terrorists, and she shall totally and actually become a twisted and tangled heap of fallen buildings and rubble. Hard to fathom.
Mm-hmm.
2,750 years ago. This was bad. Now, if I were to, if you were to play the role of prophet and said, I have a prophetic announcement, I'm announcing here in 2019 that Damascus is going to be uninhabited someday, and it's going to become a degenerate and unrestrained heap of twisted and tangled buildings and rubble. It wouldn't take much to make that prediction. A lot of Damascus is that way right now.
Almost that way.
Aleppo is that way. Right?
Yes.
Go look at pictures of Mosul. Fallujah. They're all that way. It's inevitable. Making that prediction now, slam dunk. People would laugh at you, so we have a big deal. That's like saying the sun's going to rise tomorrow. But 2,700 years ago, speaking that about a place, a city, that would be alternatively controlled by the Canaanites, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Israelites, the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Phoenicians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians. And then would be conquered by the Persians, Greeks, Romans, Byzantines, Ottomans, and then controlled by the British. And is now under the control of a vicious dictator with fleeting alliances. And yet, the city survived all of that time. And Yahweh is saying that after the Canaanites, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Israelites, the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Phoenicians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Ottomans, the British, and now Bashar al-Assad, that Damascus, the capital of Syria, the longest continually inhabited city in the world, in world history. Is that right? The longest surviving place of human habitation, according to God, is going to become a heap of twisted rubble during the last days as a catalyst to a far more egregious war. Now, when you want to prove that you are a prophet, if you want to prove that you're God and you inspired a prediction, make one like that 2,700 years before it happens. Make one like that before anyone has invented concrete or rebar, before there are explosives. Making that possible. Make it of a city that was occupied and conquered by a dozen different empires. Hey, you want to prove who you are? That you know exactly what's going to happen? That you've seen the future and reported in the past? Do this. And then, is it just for giggles? Make certain that you have the entire text of this prediction memorialized on a scroll that is found in its entirety that dates to over 200 BCE, 2,200 years ago. I'll tell you, if that isn't enough for you to say, there's no way I'm going to be an agnostic, stupid to be an atheist, and whatever this text says, if it contradicts my religion, my politics, my family values, I'm going to side with it because the spirit that inspired this is clearly God. Just saying.
Oh, yeah.
It is about what's going to happen. It is, Damascus is the canary in the mine shaft as it relates to the time of Jacob's trouble, as it relates to the harvest of Teruah, as it relates to thinning Israel at the waist, as it relates to the flood of Islamic jihadists that are part of the Magog War, as it relates to Yahweh intervening for his people and wiping them out. Damascus is the canary in the mine shaft. That's a lot. But the biggest part of this prophecy is that it in and of itself proves that Yahshua the prophet, 2,700 years ago, when he wrote this down, was inspired by a being that could see the entire fabric of time and hear it enough to report in our past what we would witness in our future. It tells you a lot about the nature of God. It tells you a lot about the style of God, the way he validates his witness, who he is, what he cares about. So it's there for you. If you want to know me, if you want to trust me, it's there for you. You just got to have the will to find it.
Wow.
Rejected and abandoned, deserted and destroyed, even damned, will be the inhabited and terrorized regions and populated cities of Aror, the reputed outcasts and exiles in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals fighting and militant militias along with their helpers, the Ansar, falling prostrate and failing miserably, ultimately ceasing because there will be no one left to terrorize. Yahshua 17:2. All right, so let's start with the outcasts in Jordan. Who are the outcasts in Jordan?
Palestinians, so-called.
Ah, you got it.
The fake Palestinians.
They are the outcasts. They are the majority of the population there. They outnumber the Jordanians. Mm-hmm. But they're complete outcasts. They still live in exile camps because the Jordanians don't trust them, don't want them. Mm-hmm. Lebanon has become a living cesspool. Really, nobody wants it. Everybody wants it. Nobody wants it. And the Shiites are trying to buy for it through Hezbollah. The Sunnis have claimed it's theirs. And there's still the Falange Christians that used to have some say, although they have been bludgeoned into oblivion. So he's saying that those regions are going to be terrorized. They aren't the terrorists. They're the victims of terror. And they're going to be abandoned and deserted, destroyed. There'll be roaming animals of militant militias. Oh, boy. Do we ever see that every day? Along with their helpers. When the mighty Mo pulled out of Mecca with about 15 or 20 adherents, that's how successful he was over the first 12 years. And he went to Yathrib, which was three quarters Jewish. And he found that the one quarter that were not Jewish, that were Arabs, were destitute. They had nothing going for themselves. And in Islam, like every religion, there's first class and second class citizens. The people of Yathrib, the Arabs there, weren't in the same league as the Meccans, even though the Meccans were few. So they were just called helpers, answer. And yet, the legions of terrorist clubs that go and bludgeon people around the world, particularly in this region, you know what they call themselves?
Ansar,
yeah, answer this, that, and everything.
Yeah. Answer with a hyphenate, yeah.
Yeah, the helpers. Right out of the crowd. Got it.
Nailed
it. Poking them right in the face, between the eyes. Yeah, that's these roving and fighting militias. Yeah, they're going to be the helpers, the Ansar. And they're going to fall prostrate, because that's what Muslims do, and they're going to fail miserably, because that's what Muslims do. Ultimately, ceasing because there'll be no one left to terrorize. You know, the greatest migration in human history is occurring right now.
The recent one?
Yeah.
The one moving out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. 5 million Syrians, Libyans, Afghanis, Iraqis, all living the hellholes that Islam had so badly corrupted and fleeing to New Zealand, Australia, the United States, Germany, England, the basis of Brexit,
a lot of friends.
Italy, Scandinavia, France, fundamentally changing those countries and making them just devastatingly anti-Semitic, because they brought the disease that had ruined their own homelands with them. That's like saying, you know, there's a bunch of people dying of Ebola. Maybe what we ought to do is bring all of those dying with Ebola into our own country. That ought to be a really good idea. Well, it's fundamentally changed the world. It set up the events that we're witnessing in the last days.
I think we have 62 people that are Muslims running for Congress to this, or Congress or Senate or something.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And look how miserable the first one has been.
Amazing.
It's just miserable. What a horrible human being. There'll be no one left to terrorize. They'll continue to flee that area, infecting the rest of the world with the most deadly disease ever known to man, Islam. To the point there'll be no one left to terrorize. America's mistake of invading Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran and fundamentally changing the balance of power between Sunnis and Shias and inflaming the entire Islamic Middle East into war, with the epicenter of that war being Syria, fundamentally changed the world. That's what God is reporting on here.
Yeah.
It was the single greatest mistake America has ever made. So God predicted that during the prelude to this war, refugees in Jordan and Lebanon would succumb as collateral damage. Then addressing the outcasts erroneously claiming to be Palestinians, the very terrorists tormenting Israel, Yahweh revealed that the refugees' camps that they would inhabit in those neighboring countries would be abandoned and depopulated. This will occur, God said, at the hands of roaming bands of militant militias. These terrorists will act more like animals than humans, and they will be operating under the name Muhammad coined for them in his Quran. Ansar, helpers. Therefore, the fortified city and its defensive structures will cease to exist on account of Ephraim. Ephraim is a synonym for Israel, apart from Yehuda. Along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria and Assyria. Today is Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. For being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted, and enraged. Well, to make this prediction, Israel would have to exist again. Because Ephraim isn't Yehuda. It's one thing for Yehuda. Yehuda existed, survived the Assyrian onslaught. The Assyrian onslaught was different than the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental difference between the Assyrian onslaught and the Babylonian onslaught is the Assyrians were just utterly ruthless. They not only hauled the children of Israel away, they did so they wouldn't return. With the Babylonians, after 70 years, they let Yehuda return. Yehudim were able to return to Yehuda. So that when the Romans came to control that which they conquered from the Greeks, the province that they controlled was the province of, not Palestine, Yehuda.
Yehuda.
So Yehuda existed all the way through 133 CE, at the time that the Romans decided they would rename the province of Yehuda after crucifying hundreds of thousands of Yehudim and of hauling the rest off into the diaspora, into slavery, salting the land and turning Jerusalem and the Temple Mount into a retreat, a holiday retreat for Rome's legions, with a temple to Jupiter and another one next door to Hadrian himself. That's when it was named Philistia, and that was the end of Yehuda. That is until the single worst genocide on a singular people in human history. The worst genocide in human history was the Islamic genocide. In the first 100 years after Muhammad's death, they wiped out half the population of the known world. The second greatest genocide in human history was actually what the Roman Catholic Church perpetrated on the Americas, the 95% diminishment of the native populations in the Americas. And are you a Roman Catholic? Shame on you. But the third overall, and the number one in terms of just one race of people, of course, of the Holocaust. And out of the Holocaust, Israel was reborn. Without Israel being reborn, this prophecy is impossible. And what is the likelihood? How many countries do you know that after being utterly destroyed, their land salted? I mean, this is like what Rome did to Carthage.
Mm-hmm.
That 2,000 years later, that the country would be reestablished with the original indigenous people.
It's unprecedented.
Yeah. Kirk, you're a historian. Why don't you list the other races and nationalities that that's happened to?
It can't. The old joke was that it was like the Indians getting New York City back. It ain't going to happen. You can't do it. Right. Wipe them out.
In most cases, the people cease to exist. They are completely and totally assimilated. They just cease to exist.
Yeah.
And
because they stayed.
That was not the case with Israel and Yehuda. They haven't completely assimilated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the way, it's still an amazing distinction. I have a friend that read to me the percentage of Nobel Prize winners across all genres in the last, whatever it is, 50 years or so. And depending on the genre, anywhere from 20% to 45% are one race of people.
Yehudim.
Yehudim.
Especially in the hard sciences.
To 45, almost 50% are one race of people. Do you know what percentage they are of the overall population?
About half of 1%.
1.5%, 2%?
Very small.
Yeah, about 0.2%.
Yeah, that's okay.
Which means there are 100 times to 250 times more likely to invent something that fundamentally changes the world. 100 times to 250 times. Staggering, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's insane.
So here we're being told that it's not just Damascus. The government of Syria is going to fall. Assyria is going to be in upheaval. They're all going to experience the same vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged people. I've said a lot of times that, you know, you can't be informed and rational and be a Christian. It's impossible.
Yeah.
But you just got to be flat-out stupid to be a Muslim. The Quran's the dumbest book ever written. Muhammad may be the single worst person ever inhabit the earth. To believe Muhammad and the Quran, you've got no excuse. I don't care how pretty your little hijab is, and how nice your smile, or how many prime ministers and presidents tell us we should be tolerant now. To be a Muslim, you are just utterly stupid. Dim-witted.
Or you're terrified of coming out against it.
Well, you can be scared to death.
And that's a lot of American parts of the world. It's a death sentence to come out against it.
Yeah, that's true. It is a death sentence to come out against Islam in an Islamic society. It's not a death sentence to come out against Islam in a non-Islamic society. So the Muslims living in the free world have no excuse.
No excuse.
And yes, it's difficult to get information. But you know, the highest readership of Prophet Doom is in Islamic countries. Internet's a powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're afraid that you're going to die by giving up something that's an utter disgusting lie, just don't tell anybody. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But you most certainly don't go off and kill others in the name of that God. Now, since Yahweh has foretold the outcome of this prelude to war and has revealed the extent of the area impacted, we know that Sunni jihadists who outman Shia Muslims 4-1 and outgun them tenfold based on the combined military expenditures on both sides, $165 billion annually for Sunni nations versus $17 billion for the majority Shia nations. You know that the South was destined to lose the civil war against the North based on very similar numbers.
Yeah, one can't.
It wasn't quite this extreme. Yeah, it wasn't this extreme, but that was impossible. The South had no chance whatsoever of prevailing. They were outgunned and outmanned. Well, this is even more extreme. And they're going to prevail after a long fight, perhaps lasting a decade or more, culminating between 2025 and 2027. The civilian populations will be devastated in the process, causing the mass exodus of Muslims the world has recently witnessed. And Islam is going to be red in tooth and claw, vehement, fanatical, dim-witted, enraged. This, of course, means that the peace process will fail, as will diplomacy. Assad, who is currently winning this war, will lose. And carnage is going to grow from hundreds of thousands to millions. 17:3. The Shia children of Israel, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Kirk, what do you think the chances that you could make that prediction 2,700 years ago, after Israel had been destroyed by Assyria, and right before they would be destroyed by Babylon?
It would be foolhardy.
You know, and even Daniel's going to write about it and say, you know, that it's going to be Babylon, and it's going to be Persia, and it's going to be Greece, and it's going to be Rome, and then it's going to be Roman Catholicism.
Yeah, it's very depressing, I would think, if you were reading that. I mean, you say, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, no chance.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, that we say Roman Catholicism, and everybody says, well, wait, what about the Nazis? They were the worst of all. Why is the Nazis on that list? What did Hitler call his organization? What did he call his Germany? Pardon?
Third Reich.
Third Reich. What was the first?
Roman Catholicism.
Imperial Rome. What was the second?
Roman Catholic.
The second?
The Holy Roman Empire, probably.
Roman Catholics. Roman Catholicism and the Holy Roman Empire. He was the third Reich. What do you think he had that stupid Aquila eagle?
Same symbols.
From his point of view, it was the third incarnation of Rome. Imperial Rome, Roman Catholicism, and then the Third Reich.
And then with the
and for those who have actually taken the time to read Hitler's Pope,
yes,
you know there would never have been a Holocaust. Hitler would never have risen to power. World War II would not have happened had it not been for Pope Pius XII. He's the man whose despicable ego made it happen. So if you were looking for the Nazis in the story, look no further than Pope Pius XII. The region associated with the Northern Kingdom is going to be a risk, but as a nation, Israel's going to survive the Syrian war. So while Iran may nuke Damascus as a parting gift for the Sunni Mujahideen who drove them out of town based upon Yahweh's witness, there is no possibility that the Iranians will deploy a nuclear bomb in the Promised Land, causing it to be uninhabitable. And since Yahweh calls the Islamic assailants vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, these fundamentalist Islamic jihadists will continue to act like savages. 17:4. And it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, most important place at the midsection of his body shall be lamed, shrinking in size, sacrificed in a counterproductive and unsustainable manner in the cause of pagan gods and as part of the hidden agenda of disease dignitaries.
Mostly Americans.
Now, Jacob. How long ago did Jacob live?
Well, he's Abraham's grandson, so a long time ago.
Yeah. How about 3 bills times 10?
Mm-hmm.
3,000 years ago, right? My guess is that what was what is left of Jacob's carcass, wherever it is then by it more than just a waste. Yeah. Okay. So, what is he talking about when he's talking about Jacob? What is unique about Jacob?
That is Israel. That was his name. Changed name.
Right. He became Israel. Yep. Did he become? Was he the father of part of Israel, like Yehuda?
All 12.
Was Ephraim, you know, one of just his only son?
No.
No, he had a whole lot of them.
12 of them.
Every tribe that is part of Israel came from Jacob. So what Jacob represents is the totality of Israel. So the country of Israel shall be decreased to the point that it is no longer sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, most important place at her midsection shall be leaned, streaking in size. Where's the midsection of Israel? Ever look at the map?
Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
That is correct. What percentage of Israel's population live between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem?
Probably around 70, don't you think?
Yeah, about 70%.
Up there.
Yeah, that's right.
When you give them the West Bank and all the lands that UN 242 ascribes to them,
mm-hmm.
about how wide is Israel going to be between the cities of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem?
It's just a few miles. It could be 15, maybe.
About 7 miles. About 7 miles.
That's small.
Uh-huh.
Smaller.
And there'll be a conduit in between them, dissecting Israel in half to allow the wannabe Philistines to migrate between Gaza and the West Bank. Now, Gaza's already been given away. What a hellacious mistake. And no one the world over said, boy, that was really stupid. George Bush, you ought to have your head examined for having proposed that. That was really a dumb idea. They don't care. So long as Israel's bludgeoned, they're thrilled. World leaders, even most of the rubble of the world. But when this is done, Israel is 7 miles wide at her waist. She becomes indefensible.
Why does no one point out that it is us who did this?
No one's pointing out that it's us, the United States. That is going to force them to give up the West Bank. And you might say, well, you know, the Trumpster just gave them, you know, credit for the Golan. You know, it can't be America standing up for Israel.
Nah.
The Trump is also the guy that said, we don't care that Crown Prince Mohammed had a Washington Post journalist murdered and his body dismembered. And I don't care that Mikey, which was his pet name, when he was a teenager, killed his two housekeepers. We don't care that they're savages. We don't care that, you know, 80% of the 9/11 jihadists came from Saudi Arabia. We don't care that the Islamic terrorists that we sacrificed another 10,000 lives directly and 300,000 indirectly through suicide. Osama bin Laden was a Saudi Arabian. We're going to sell them hundreds of billions of dollars worth of the most advanced American weapons. That's just how we roll. So if you're the primary weapons supplier to Israel's enemies, you sell 10 times more weapons to Israel's enemies than the rest of the world combined. You sell many times more weapons to Israel's enemies than you do to Israel. Whose side are you on? Really?
You know, Yahweh's.
Sure. You look at how much business America does with Israel's enemies versus Israel. When you look at the money that American politicians are given once they leave office, you know, the George W. Bush, $20 million for a search speech. The Clinton Foundation, another $20 million immediately after he left office. By the Saudis. How does people not realize those were bribes and that both men sold America out for money? Well, anyway, it's God saying that Israel's going to be thinned at the waist. UN 242, with the thing the whole world has been clamoring for, is going to happen. It's inevitable. Then Israel at the waist. What happened when Neville Chamberlain thought it would be a good idea to give away what was not Great Britain's? Czechoslovakia, the high ground of Czechoslovakia. When he decided, we're going to achieve peace in our time with Nazi Germany by giving them what they wanted. God, just give them what they want. Everything will be fine. We'll have peace. That was Neville Chamberlain's plan, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How'd that work out?
Mm-hmm. Well, they invaded
Poland within 6 months.
Czechoslovakia, they went to Poland, France.
Poland,
yeah.
Yeah.
Going.
Yeah, and then every bit of Europe that they could control, pretty much save Great Britain, which they bombed into just about oblivion. But they cut deals to occupy and control Spain and Italy, even all of northern Africa. They surrounded the Mediterranean. They owned it. It was theirs. For a while. You know, if you read the papers published in Germany during that time, the generals were on the cusp of overthrowing Hitler. I thought he was a crazy dude. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And when the West needed Czechoslovakia, it was such a boost for Hitler that the generals dared not oppose him. Of course, the single greatest victory that Adolf Hitler achieved in his rise to power was the treaty that he signed with the Roman Catholic Church, which dispersed the German Catholic Party and had the Roman Catholic Church endorsed the Nazi government of Germany and give Adolf Hitler a green light for the final solution. Hitler spent more time working on that agreement and achieved more by it than any other thing he ever did. But anyway, that is the historic president. Neville Chamberlain gave the Nazi Germans what they craved, the high ground of Czechoslovakia, and the consequence was World War II. The United States will seek to appease Islamic jihadists after they've destroyed Syria and Iraq and Iran and Lebanon and Jordan and Syria, and they're poised to bludgeon the rest of the world and say, well, what they want is Israel. Let's just give it to them.
That'll
lead to World War III. This prophecy doesn't explain how the proxy war being fought in Syria leads to the divestiture of Israeli land, but we have a historical analog from which to draw conclusions. A similar war was fought in Afghanistan, 1978 to 1992, when America rented the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the Pakistanis and then armed them. The Islamic jihadists recruited and deployed sympathetic Sunni Muslims from all around the world to wage war against the pro-Soviet government. The fighting between the Islamic Mujahideen and the communists, as well as between the rival jihadists, was so savage, America's grand plan caused over 1 million Afghani citizens to die. Another 5 million were forced to seek asylum. Their country, which was all but destroyed during the war, was further ravaged by the Taliban, who replaced the Mujahideen, who had disposed of the secular government. Well, this is going to play out again in Syria, ostensibly because mankind never seems to learn from history. But this time, the population is much greater. The location is much more vital, and the weapons are much more lethal. We should expect that what happened in the aftermath of the great jihad in Afghanistan will occur again, but to a greater extent. In the decade after the Sunni victory in Afghanistan, once tens of thousands of international terrorists returned home, going back to Africa, Asia, the Americas, Russia, and Europe, they continue to be terrorists. They struck savagely on every continent, carrying out some of the most heinous terrorist attacks ever witnessed. And this leads us right back to Israel, because the next wave of Islamic terrorism, consistent with the previous one, will be orchestrated by religious fundamentalists who will cite their Quranic-inspired hatred of Israel to justify their atrocities. They will ultimately seek to destroy the nation they blame for their poverty. conspiracy runs rampant in the Islamic world. Why? Because most Muslims are losers. They have no control of their lives. They want to blame everybody else for their sorry condition.
They all swore up and down the Holocaust never happened. That was a conspiracy by the Germans.
You know, you want to announce who you are? You want to declare the world who you really are? Promote a conspiracy. You might as well just put the big L on your forehead. Internationally, the rapid decline in support for Israel will be seen as an invitation to invade, precipitating carnage on an unheralded scale. The flood of Islamic terrorists will be so great worldwide, Israel will be sacrificed to appease the most intolerant and indoctrinated, the most destructive and deadly people on earth. Since past behavior is the most accurate indicator of future behavior, this is the most likely scenario. The devastating conclusion of the proxy war in Syria will lead to a tsunami of terrorism sweeping the globe, and then to Israel. It's going to be sacrificed in a veiled plea for peace. Now, this was written 2,700 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, isn't it?
You think that somebody in Washington, in London, in Paris, in Moscow, in Beijing, would read it and say, hey, this is a really dumb idea. It's not going to work. We need Plan B. No. They're too full of themselves to consider what God has to say. It's just inevitable. It's the greatest blunder in American history. As we now know, this outcome is already in process, but the final divestiture of land is not going to occur on the timetable once demanded by the Bush or Obama administrations. It will happen only after the Syrian war is over. This timing is further underscored because elements of this peace treaty appear to be referenced in Daniel and Daniel in conjunction with the commencement of the time of Jacob's troubles. And as we know, the other analog for this is Neville Chamberlain. Well, now, vulnerable and no longer defensible, Muslims will void the treaty with Israel, just as Muhammad had done in the 7th century to justify his conquest of Mecca. 1,400 years ago, after promising to be peaceful for a decade in the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, by the way. By the way, you know, I just thought this was an interesting thing. I said in a previous show, I asked, what tribe did Muhammad hail from?
Yehudim.
Hashem, the name. What city was he born?
Yathrib.
Mm-hmm. What was the population of Yathrib? The mix.
Mostly
75% Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
His father died, and yet his mother, a widow, still had enough money to hire somebody to rear the kid. And the Arabs there were destitute. So, what are the chances that a person of the Hashem, a name, tribe, being born in a town that was 75% Islamic, whose mother, a widow, had the means to give him up to be raised by someone else, was Jewish? 90%?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go a little further.
Yeah.
I had a friend that did a little genetic research.
Yeah.
There are a number of people who can claim today to be direct descendants of Muhammad through Fatima, his daughter, and through her children. On the male side, King Abdullah of Jordan is one of them, slave to Allah. you know what? He's a Jew.
Wow. Wow.
Muhammad was a Jew.
Yeah.
Just like Paul. Just like Adam Weishaupt.
Like Hitler's grandparents.
Just like Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Anyway, this is going to be an invitation for invasion. Yeshaya 17:5. Then it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest at the proper time, a time in the end which must be cut short due to the extent of man's provocation and anger. Reaping the grain from the chaff in season, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby establishing and validating the standing grain. Then his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and ability to shoulder burdens, and his visible appearance as light, shall be collecting and harvesting the first fruits. And it shall be as one would conduct a gleaning, a smaller secondary harvest of first fruits in the valley of Raphaim, in the midst of those destined to die, who were too lazy to exert the effort required to prevail.
Huh.
You know, the Christians are all fascinated with their rapture. Of course, that's a Pauline term, and in the very discussion of the rapture, Paul got it wrong. He said it was going to happen during his lifetime. So, you know, if you're a Pauline Christian, you're looking in your New Testament for it, and there you go. It's going to happen during Paul's life. He was wrong. Maybe you ought not believe him. It's like kind of the Jews. And considering Rabbi Akiba as the father of rabbinic Judaism, when he's the guy that's most responsible for the diaspora.
Yep.
Well, here, Yahweh tells us exactly when the true harvest is going to occur. A, Damascus, the longest inhabited city in the world, is going to be destroyed and become a heap, a twisted heap of ruins. The government of Syria is going to fall. Jihadists are going to go crazy worldwide. And then Israel is going to be forced to give up not only Gaza, but the West Bank, and it's going to be thinned at the waist, so she becomes indefensible. And after all of those things happen, then the true harvest occurs. How hard is that to figure out? You know, why have all of these groups, the Jehovah's Witness, the Seventh-day Adventists, have been all gone out and predicted this day, and they've been off by 100, 150 or more years? Let's give you the timing. It's going to happen on Teruah right after this all occurs, these five things. Between now and the time they occur, it isn't going to happen. We do not have to worry that it's going to happen this Teruah. It's not. Damascus stands. The Syrian government stands. There isn't a worldwide plague of the consequences being discussed here of Islamic terrorism. Israel has not yet been forced to forfeit the land in a peace treaty. Don't have to worry about it happening this year. Not going to happen next year. But it will happen absolutely and unequivocally before 2030. I think the most likely is 2026, 2027. And everyone that's part of Yahweh's covenant family is going to be removed from the earth. It's going to happen at a time that must be cut short due to the extent of man's provocation and anger. You know, there's never been a period like that in all of human history. Man has never had the capacity to wipe out life on the planet.
Yeah.
But we do now.
Wow.
So, from the valley of death, those destined to die because they were too damn lazy to exert the effort required to prevail. And that's it, folks. It's nothing more than that. All you little people out there that are being religious, shame on you. If you only exerted the effort. You know, when I met with this fellow and his wife, yesterday I had lunch with him. Extraordinary. He deserves 100% of the credit for where he is. He's only read the books. He put up speakers where he was having breakfast every day, where he took a shower, where he was getting dressed. He played every daggone poor guy, every archive of this program. Thank you, JB, and others for posting them.
Indeed. Thank you, JB.
And then every time he would stop the recording, he would write down what he had said and said, I'm going to go check that. 50% of what he heard.
Wow.
He put in the effort to check. He bought Logos. Validate, validate, validate. And after a while, he wasn't validating, but celebrating. He put in the effort.
Yeah.
Genuinely, he earned the reward. I mean, to the extent that we all earn the reward. We do so by taking the time to learn the truth and engaging, acting upon it. It was just a wonderful celebration of where he had been and really how close his wife is to being there as well. And those who are left behind to die, just too lazy. It's all those people that would rather yammer to God, sing their songs to God, go to a church sermon where somebody speaks about God, rather than just listen to God. Right before the Muslim attack. Pardon?
I said that just seems like the easier way to go to me. And then I can actually
approach you
because I verified it.
Yeah. You know, and after a while, you go from verifying to celebrating. You still do the checks, but the checks aren't checks to say, well, is this translation accurate? You do them because you learn so much more when you do it yourself. And when you do it yourself, the material becomes part of you. Remember how many times I said, please, don't cite anything in any of these books until you own it. Until you understand it, until you agree with it. Until, rather than presenting, well, this is what this guy wrote, in yada yada, you can say, because this is what God said. And when you go from just reading it, and then from validating it, to expanding your knowledge because you engage, to translate words yourself, becomes part of the fabric of your life. And that's what he did. Marvelous. So we all should do. So this is going to occur on Yom Teruah, the first day of the seventh month on Yahweh's calendar. And since God transitioned from his declaration regarding the impending destruction of Syria to the immediate divestiture of Israeli land, using the phrase, in that day, these events are going to play out in swift succession, most likely in the same year. Once the Syrian war is over, once Damascus becomes an uninhabited pile of rubble, once the Assad regime falls, once the refugees who are outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon are swallowed up in this deadly affair, once Israel is then becoming unsustainable, be prepared to go if you're a participant in the covenant. And if not, you may want to consider its conditions and engage before it's too late. And in him, in Jacob, and thus Israel, there will be those souls who will be spared and survive, and the physical bodies of those who will be left behind, gleanings of those purposely left on the vine, as in going around at the right time of year to remove them from a threatening and dangerous situation, encompassing them as a means of harvesting an olive tree. Two or three. three ripe olives from the top, uttermost branch, four or five on its fruitful and productive branches, which are separated and cut away. Prophetically declares Yahweh, the Almighty God of Israel. Interesting. This is the true harvest. And he's not the God of the church. He's not the God of Christians. He's not the God of Gentiles. He's still the God of Israel. Pretty hard to promote replacement theology on that basis, isn't it?
Impossible, I would think.
Pretty much.
It's 2,000 or 3,000 from the uppermost branch. The uppermost branch is Israel. The fruitful branch are Goyim.
Wait. Uh-huh.
So, we're talking about 7,000 people. 7,000 people is more than I think some of those that I respect very much in our group. You know, I get lots of emails from people I have a very high regard for that says, it's got to be 700. It can't be 7,000 based on what we know. And, you know, I understand that, and I'm disagreeing with them. But it doesn't mean that I agree either. I think the number really is going to be 7,000. I'm getting now two letters a week from people that I've never heard from before that are coming. And the target audience for all these books always has been and always will be Israel, Yehuda. And things are going to get really bad for Israel and Yehuda. And one of the advantages that Israel and Yehuda has over most Goyim, mm-hmm. is that, you know, like this, the woman that was just so charming, what a lovely lady. Many people, being honest, because no one could possibly guess who they are, so I'm not divulging any inside secrets about them. But she said during lunch, she says, you know, you got to read these books with a dictionary. Inferring that the vocabulary was reasonably advanced. And it's probably true. And it's true because I'm not willing to dumb it down. And I was really smart. And I'm going to be on my best game. If I've got a word that's more ideal for what he's trying to say, I'm going to use that word. You know, I think God's really smart, and I want to give him credit. And I want to reflect to the greatest of my ability what he had to say. And she says, so, you know, you have to read with a dictionary. Well, remember I just shared with you that Israelites are between 100 and 250 times more likely to be brilliant. Do you think that Israel will need a dictionary to figure this out?
No.
When times get tough and Israel learns that they don't have to accept dead God on a stick, that they don't have to accept the God that they're accused of killing, that they don't have to accept a Jesus Christ. When they realize that the person that is calling them home is right at their heart, it's Dode. When they realize that, and they stumble upon these predictions as they're presented in the language that they all speak, English, there's going to be 7,000. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, 7,000, you say, well, that's pathetic for 7 billion people in the world. That's a really good number. A really good number.
Yeah.
You know, I'm clearly Yahweh is a blend of extrovert and introvert. I'm a blend of extrovert and introvert. You put me in a crowd of like 100 or so people that I don't share anything in common with, and man, I want to die 1,000 deaths. Get me out. I mean, my whole body is going to scream, get me out of this place. Well, a true extrovert would draw energy from it. You know, you put me in front of everybody and give me an opportunity to share to do that, but just being a crowd of people that don't want to. What happened, and this might be my, well, I can't call God an introvert. Sure I can. What happened every time Yosha?
Himself?
Every time Yosha was in a crowd of people, what did he do?
Got to get away.
Immediately.
Did he pick
12,000 disciples?
12.
Now 12.
Right.
Yeah. He's as much introvert as the rest of us. 7,000, that's a lot. Yeah. That really is. That's a lot. It's a good number. For those who are called out of the world at this time are described as standing grain. And then it's ripe olives. That's two of the three metaphors. Now, Yahweh has three metaphors to explain who the members of his family are. Grain, olives, and grapes. Those three things have something in common. They all have to be crushed before they produce the product that they're best known for, olive oil, bread, and wine. You know, I began the show, and I no longer feel like it's indulgent for me to share aspects of my life. And everybody knows I have a dog named Asher. I have a boat named Kara that I live now down in South Florida in Fort Lauderdale. They know about my relationship with my youngest son, the fact that I'm divorced, and the reasons for it. You know. And the reason I've shared that is we're family. And as we progress through this, there are just times where I think it's important to know and to feel a sense of connectedness. And this is one of those times where, you know, it's important that we know what God is doing and when He is doing it and why He is doing it. And so to see these events transpire in this way, and you know, I'm surrounded by Jews here.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelming percentage of the people that are my neighbors. And you know what? Something else that's really interesting. Not only are they all really lovely and fun, loving people, they're almost all homosexuals. Interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what the most homosexual city is in the world, too? I mean, just speaking of, by the way, I know that there's a lot of Christians that want to associate Sodom with homosexuality, and there's no tent of homosexuality there, but it's Tel Aviv. So, I mean, God's got definitely has an issue with there. But those three things are all crushed to be effective. And the reason I was sharing that is when I had this issue yesterday with my youngest son crushing my heart. My eldest son crushing my heart. I woke up this morning more inspired than ever to be productive. And it may have been the single most productive day I've ever had in translating insights and commentary.
Big statement.
There is an advantage of being crushed. Israelites are going to be crushed as we move forward over these next 10 years. And out of that's going to be the sweetest wine, the tastiest bread, the most brilliant light. That's where our character is forged. It's where our backbone is established. You know, when the going is easy, it's easy to get going. But when it's tough, that's what defines our character. So, you know, that's why I share sometimes, you know, my life is, I don't have a joyous life. I'm the happiest guy in the world. I mean, I really am the happiest guy in the world. What a wonderful opportunity to be doing what we're doing. And I'm not alone. That's the common denominator, better by the governor. It's just exciting. Uplifting. But we all have issues. We all have challenges. And it's through those challenges that who we are can be seen by others. How we grow. Do you think that Yahweh has it easy? How'd you like to be God over this Sodom?
Because he just didn't wipe us out. Sometimes when you look.
You know, one of the things that struck me as I was read this email from my eldest son was, so now I know how God feels. And this was over an instant. You know, I've done a lot of things in my life that I'm not proud of. A lot of things. Oh, I would love a mulligan on that one. This happened to me over something that was probably the best thing. It was the one thing that I had done where everything over the past 35 years from its very inception to this point, every single move along the way was genuine, forthright, honorable, selfless, generous. Now, I can't say that about a lot of stuff, you know. I'm flawed like everybody else. But this was one thing that I had really done right. And it caused my son to write language that was hateful. And so I thought a moment for Yahweh. Think of what he did for us vis-a-vis Pesach and Matzah and Bekonim. Think of the aggravation that he went through to liberate his people, to establish the covenant, to defend Israel. And all the while, his children were twisting the best that he had done and showing their not just lack of appreciation, but actual antipathy towards the God who had done all these marvelous things for them, who had consistently been forthright and generous, selfless. And so, to have that experience is really a good thing. Because the best way that we have, the best opportunity we have to be genuine when we are conveying Yahweh's testimony and explaining what it means in our lives and what the opportunity is, if we can see the world from his perspective, and if we speak from his perspective, then we're vastly more effective than we could be in any other way. When we translate from his perspective, but how do you get his perspective unless you have those experiences? And yet you have the Yitzhak moments. And you have the aha moments with Abraham. You have the Dabarim moments with Moshe. You have the Mizmor experiences with Dod. If you don't have both the celebration of family and the anguish of family, how in the world are you prepared to explain Yahweh's interaction with his people? You know, yes, he used standing grain, grapes, and olives, all three of which have to be crushed to be useful. All three are spectacular. You know, I had a cheater form of Pesach tonight. I cooked the best rakalam I've ever barbecued. And I had my, actually I just love olive oil and bitter herbs. I had my olive oil and bitter herbs. I had my red wine. And my cheater version, because it's not Pesach, I had a French baguette as my dipping bread, because it's not yet Pesach. And there must have been, it's not a dine de luxe, just the timing of the show and everything. I must have exclaimed 30 times during my meal, just, good God, this is a wonderful meal. I am so delighted that you love lamb. I'm so delighted that you love dipping bread and olive oil and herbs. I am so glad that red wine is the beverage that you've decided to augment your meal, because I could eat this every day. It was just so good. It was celebration of flavor.
I had never had lamb before until the first time I celebrated Pesach, and it's become my absolute favorite piece of meat. If I could afford it, I would eat that all the time. I love lamb.
Oh, yeah. Now, I'm a little bit of a Torah snob when it does come to my lamb. You know, Yah was not big on us eating the fat on the
yeah.
And lambs can be a fatty meat. You should see me work my rack of lamb over before I put it on the grill. And then I figure if the bitter herbs are good for that olive oil dipping sauce, it's going to be really good on the lamb. And so, man, I have my favorite recipe, and I coat my lamb with olive oil and then all of my favorite herbs. And the only way I'll make it is over an open flame. I'll barbecue that sucker.
I've been contemplating the idea of smoking one just for, not for Pesach, but just to see how it comes out, because I love smoke.
That'd be great.
But for Pesach, I always go
You really don't have to smoke lamb, because the meats that are smoked are usually meats that the cartilage, whatever it is in the meat that has to break down for it to be tender. And that it creates that bark on the outside that is so spectacular, and the meat turns a reddish pink on the inside, even when it's cooked medium well. So much flavor. And so I think it'd be a fun experiment with lamb. I grill mine. And, when that olive oil is kind of sizzled and seared and impregnated with all of those wonderful herbs, and I love rosemary and marjoram and thyme and a little basil and salt and pepper, and it goes on and on with I put on it. Wow.
That's good. He's got a little rosemary really plant in the backyard. I go snip off and put in some fresh rosemary on it.
And fresh rosemary on it. The only thing that I would add to fresh rosemary to get my favorite rack of lamb is I happen to like roasted garlic. I'm just a huge fan of roasted garlic. Yeah, you don't want to be around me when I've had my favorite meal because it's going to have roasted garlic in it. And so I always encourage going to dinner with friends that also like roasted garlic, because we all eat it, and it doesn't bother anybody.
Yeah, and it's not a big deal.
No, it's not a big deal. But we're getting close to celebrating Pesach. About 10 days or so.
19th.
A little more than 10 days. 14 days. I can't wait. We're at 17:06. So we've got a little ways to go here before we finish this chapter. And I just think that the prophetic nature of this, and so many people interested in prophecy, and with this getting the timeline of everything that's going to happen between now and Yah's return, this is worth our time to go through this. And we may take a step back rather than a step forward, and go to 15 and 16 rather than 18 when this is done, because I probably won't be able to help myself. And I've sent you all early versions of chapter 11 of Observations of Our Time, which I renamed Where the Torah's Voice Died. Because Moab, by the way, was where the Torah's voice died. Torah's voice was Moshe. Nebo is in Moab. Moab is a tiny little place. That is where the Torah's voice died. And, of course, the voice of the Torah was mutilated in Paul's letters and Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the first, 30 pages of that chapter that I've been working on these last few days, maybe a week or so. It is so exciting. We're just going to have, it's going to be so much fun to go through. And I've not shared, I think I've only shared with one person thus far, because I'm writing it from the inside out, so it's really hard to send out, because you can't say, you can edit these X number of pages, because I'm writing it from the inside out as opposed from beginning to end or some other way that makes sense to edit. So I got big gaps in the middle. I know where it's going, but this has been the most challenging material I've ever translated or commented on. because my mindset was still so stained by English translations that I had avoided it like the plague. I mean, who wants to read about a father offering his daughters up to be raped, to be gang raped, and about a father having drunken incest with his daughters? You know, in Christianity, we'll promote it as it's their exemplar of the rapture. Well, yeah, hell it is. You know, of the four people that left, one of the four was turned to a pillar of salt before she got out of eyesight. And two of them got their father drunk and had sex with him and gave birth to scum.
Mm-hmm.
And the dad? This is not the dad of the year. But the story is so much more important, so much bigger than that, that I'm glad that that I was finally strong-armed into doing it. But anyway, guys, it's been a pleasure. I'm sorry. This is probably the most I've talked on any show, and I apologize for that. It's just different material where we're reading summations and not talking about each individual word and just trying to figure out where it goes.
No, I'm sure we enjoyed it. Everybody listening, I'm sure did. Thank you.
Look forward to being with you next week. It's an exciting time to be alive and to be Torah observant, and it's a wonderful time to celebrate the Shabbat and the Torah. Asha says hello to everyone out there in listener land. She's gone from being the cutest little puppy you ever saw that you could palm in one hand to being about a foot and a half tall and 3.5 feet long, maybe 4 feet long, and she just looks like right now a thin and cute Labrador. She's lost her puppy, although she has not lost her. The puppy inside her remains while the puppy outside.
That takes several years for a lab.
Yes. But, oh, my goodness, is she adorable and smart. Oh, this dog, I mean, already she knows that you want to open a door. You reach up and you pull down the door handle.
Oh, wow.
You want to go for a walk, you go off and get your leash. You know, she understands, well, if I come, if I sit down, if I lay down, if I do any of the commands I've been taught, I get a treat. Let's play that game. Yeah, she's really a sweetheart. So it's lots and lots of fun. Sweet little personality. I'm so delighted that I decided to get a dog. Yeah, you just see dogs keep you young, put a smile on your face. Marvelous company. Was it two nights ago? Because of the falling out that I had, I was up till 1 o'clock in the morning writing a letter. And the next day, that was the one son, and then the next day I got up at 6, and I spent 4 hours writing the other son a letter after having slept about 30 minutes during the night. And you know who was with, I mean, every moment. If I was at the computer, she was at my feet, wrapped around my feet. If I needed to get up to get a drink or anything, followed me and laid down right where I stood. Time to go to bed. Not only jumped up, she's got little steps now. That she prefers to sleep in her own bed than the master bath. That's her favorite because it's cool in there and she can really, you know, she can snore up a storm and she's a snorer. There's just certain nights where she just realizes, you know, this is a cuddle support night.
He needs me.
Oh, he needs me. She put her head right next to mine on the pillow and spent all night that way.
Wow.
You know, just dogs have a sense about them.
Oh, yeah.
What a great dog.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she is. She's so much dog to be around. Anyway, it was fun tonight. Happy Shabbat to one and all. We're a couple of weeks here from Pesach. I have a chance to celebrate the the happiest day of the year.
Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Happy Shabbat, everyone. Good night.
Bye.
Shalom.